Now, it's too early to know yet whether it will prove eventually that it was the establishment of the equal right to learn, or the equal right to vote, or the equal right to work, which proved to be man's most effective instrument in repairing the effects of his egotism that had taken the form of racial prejudice. But for the time being, there is good practical sense in recognizing the implications of the fact that there's one demand which is rising like a chorus or a chant above every other refrain, and that demand is for jobs. It's only in the euphemisms of the statutes that this insistence is reflected in terms of fair employment practices and equal employment opportunity. The demand, as it's being made and as it's being meant, is a demand for jobs, period, and now. And it's true beyond this that most fair-minded people today have come to the realization, in some cases quietly, that under all the circumstances, this is a fair demand. And if this is true, what is called for is a great deal more than the legal enforcement of statutory prohibitions against overt acts of discrimination by employers and labor unions. You will immediately suggest at this point that if there is something more, it's for something other than the law to attend to. And I think it's important to realize that this particular area of civil rights and civil results does present more difficulties for the law and for lawyers than to some of the other areas. You see, establishing the civil right to vote or to get an education at the public expense or to have a trial by jury composed of one's peers is only a matter of extending to everyone what the law has always recognized as part of most people's right and the only necessity, and one which the law meets in its traditional custom and habit, is to extend that previously established right to everybody. Not so with respect to employment. For in this particular area, it's always been recognized, or it's never been recognized, that anybody has a right to a job, which is what is sought here. And so an employer has always been entirely free to refuse to hire on the basis of almost any other prejudice, except for union sympathies. And yet here, he may not rely on the prejudice against those of a certain race or sex. And so when you think it through, the law is entering here upon what is for it a very strange and uncertain, previously forbidden territory. Despite whatever complications there may be, so long as the law of employment civil rights is considered only a matter of prohibiting discrimination, in the sense of prohibiting any overt discriminatory action, the law will remain substantially incomplete. And there's something wrong if one man who is turned away from a factory gate because he is a Negro is accepted by the law as a proper party plaintiff, while another who's turned away because he is untrained is not recognized as a proper party plaintiff, even though the reason he is untrained is that he was born in a ghetto and his education was as unequal as it was separate. If this is what the law says, the law, in Dickens' very pungent phrase, is an ass. For the two cases are exactly the same, except that an employer did the discriminating in the one case and the society did it in the other. If a person has been put at a disadvantage so far as employment is concerned because of his race, this is as much a matter warranting redress as if he is denied a job through overt discrimination. And I suggest that most of the disadvantage which affects this problem today is simply the accumulated result of society's continuing discrimination over so long a period of time. And in lawyers' terms, there's no statute of limitations running as far as this particular crime is concerned. And in this same connection, there's too much of a tendency in this country today on the part of society to feel that by pleading guilty, as it did in its enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it's absolved itself from any further responsibility. Apparently, on some sense of turning state's evidence against ourselves or something of the kind. Now, it's not necessary to conclude, as Gilbert and Sullivan do someplace in Iolanthe, that the law is the true embodiment of everything that's excellent. There is no escape from the conclusion, however, that so far as any meaningful law of employment civil rights is concerned, that law cannot be limited to the prohibition of discrimination. It has got to include provision, in one form or another, for a substantial degree of affirmative action. And it's at this point that the law starts to have trouble. Such affirmative action has got to be, in part, the responsibility of the private parties involved. And this concept of affirmative action as part of the requirement of observing the civil rights provisions has been developed quite extensively in the administration of the executive orders covering the employment practices of government contractors and of the unions representing their employees. In very large part, however, the affirmative action required to meet the fact and the problem of disadvantage, the result of the broad discrimination of the society as a whole, will have to be taken by the society acting through government processes. Chief among these is education. I find more than fortuity or accident or coincidence in the fact that this fund combines the attention to legal defense and to education. That is a proper and a constructive combination. With respect to education, there seems to me every reason to grant preference to those who have had to watch others given preference in the past. This need not, indeed it should not, be along racial lines, for disadvantage is one thing that's been integrated in this country for a very long time. The Teachers' Corps legislation, which President Johnson has been pressing so strongly upon the Congress, is just one illustration of the kind of action that's called for. And yet, we would all agree here that it'd be wrong to wait for the meeting of this situation through the normal educational processes. Too many of the victims, for one thing, the victims of accumulated disadvantage, are now past the school age. And the employment of fathers is an important element in the educational motivation of their sons. You observed yesterday the 12th anniversary of Brown against the Board of Education. There's a coincidence between that period and the period which we commonly recognize as the period of education. So a whole generation has gone through the elementary and the high school grades since the day that that decision was passed. And yet none here would find more than a modicum of achievement as far as making up in this particular area is concerned. We can't wait that long. The Manpower Development and Training Act and the Economic Opportunity Act programs are devised to meet the disadvantage problem in some of its most acute present forms. And I thought if we had longer to talk a little bit about the affirmative action, which is part of those programs, but you know something about them, and Jim has supplied some, at least, of the suggestive detail. I want to talk this noon, finally, about one administrative practice that requires, in my judgment, review and revision in the light of the recognition now of civil rights as the law, and particularly in view of the necessity at this stage of emphasizing an affirmative action program to meet the ravages of discrimination and disadvantage. I'm issuing today, with full realization of some of the negative implications of it, issuing today instructions which change materially and in fact reverse the previous Department of Labor policy regarding racial identification on employment records. Now, most of us in this room, at various times in our lives, various points in the past, have fought, and we have fought hard, against the marking on any employment record of a person's race. You have, and I have, as arbitrator, as teacher, as employer, as administrator. We weren't under any illusions about the superficiality of the success of our efforts, for we were formed successful. Those ugly words, ugly because they were irrelevant, white non-white, were left off. But we knew that there remained the check marks up in a corner someplace, the underlining of an applicant's middle name, or the name of a school that he had attended, which happened to be in a ghetto, or the notation courteous and polite if the job seeker or employee was white, but polite and courteous if he wasn't. And yet, the symbolic point of whether race was or was not to be recognized as relevant was important. We won our point, and winning it helped straighten out a country's thinking. It helped pass a law. Now, there is the necessity not only of enforcing that law, which among other things requires action where there is a pattern of discrimination, but beyond that, there is this necessity of developing a program of affirmative action. I am asked, and properly, as a government employer, whether my staff is fairly comprised of people of different races, and I, in turn, demand this information of every supervisor in the department, so that I, in turn, am introduced in terms of the number of non-white employees whom I have today working for me. I am asked, and properly, by congressional committees about the racial distribution of trainees under the Manpower Development and Training Act and the Neighborhood Youth Corps program. I am required, and properly, by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to see to it that the responsibilities of the Federal State Employment Service are discharged faithfully and without prejudice. And I am required, and properly, under the executive order covering the employment practices of federal contractors and unions representing their employees, to require their going beyond non-discrimination to the taking of affirmative action to overcome the effects of disadvantage. Now, in none of these programs can anyone condone making a numbers game out of the responsibility of eliminating discrimination. I didn't know some of the figures that were mentioned here this noon. I didn't know, Jim, that there was 27% of the first 100,000 trainees of the Manpower Development and Training Act who were non-white. I knew that the number was too small, and in that particular case, that's enough, and it still is. But we can't make a numbers game out of this, and I don't know how all of you feel about it, but as far as I'm concerned, if it should lead to the establishment of ratios, it would be wrong, for I think ratios preserve a discrimination and perpetuate a false difference. At the same time, it remains part of administrative necessity, with programs as large as these involving tens and hundreds of thousands of people, to rely to some extent on statistical reports, if only for the purpose of looking to see where there may or may not be trouble. And keeping these statistics requires record identification. And there's one other thing. I'm sick and tired of the false piety of those who answer inquiries about the racial aspects of their employment or membership practices with the bland, smug answer that, oh, we don't know that, because, of course, we don't keep records about that kind of thing.